This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, good morning. This is The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin, with me, Julian Ng and Ibrahim Sunny. Looking forward to a day chock full with interesting and provocative interviews, including one that I'm doing. I'm actually interviewing Dr. Joseph Lien Yi-Sung. He is a former editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Economic Journal. And it's this interview on the grill, which happens at 8 o'clock, is quite timely, guys, because, you know, I don't know if you've been watching the news about three of the people elected to the Hong Kong Legislative Council have been rejected from entering because apparently they use that opportunity to swear in to, well, actually kind of swear. You know, they protested okay. China.
That's a new one.
Yeah, and China's dominance of Hong Kong politics. So that's led to them being in the news over the last week or so. And I speak to Joseph because this interview was done before this current events unfolded. And so I don't ask him about that. It happened a couple of weeks after the Legislative Council elections. But here's some interesting views on where the kind of how the scenarios might unfold for Hong Kong vis-a-vis China.
So he is a journalist, is it?
No, he's actually an economist, lived in the U.S. for many years. And when he came back to Hong Kong, the Hong Kong government actually picked him up, and he was part of their main think tank, and he was with them. But it was when he started to openly show support for the democratic movement that they sort of asked him to retire. And I think that led to, you know, several years of him being seen as somewhat of an antagonist to the pro-Beijing faction and the pro-Beijing government of Hong Kong. Yeah.
So the three people that was blocked or because they used the swearing-in session to swear, are they allowed into the hall?
They were in the hall when they took the thing, but I remember one of the images that was shown on television was one of the young women actually had a banner, and she spread the banner out and said, "Hong Kong is not China," you know, and it's things like that. So it's been kind of a bit of a spectacle in terms of the start of this process, because, you know, what is being argued by some factions of the Hong Kong community is that in many ways the Chinese have, Beijing as it were, really, has violated its own basic laws, the rules of its own game that it was established almost 20 years ago. I think if you think, cast your mind back, it was 1997. It's almost next year, it'll be 20 years since the reunification of the handover.
And they're supposed to leave Hong Kong untouched for a good for 50 years, and that's already half of that 50 right now. I guess you could say that if you wanted to be cynical, you could say that China is already taking steps towards the end of that 50 years.
Absolutely, it's 2047, and you know, you think 50 years is a lot of time. It really does pass very quickly. And some of the older folks in the studio will know that.
I remember that a lot of Hong Kong people and some of my Hong Kong friends pre-97, which was the date that the British passed Hong Kong back to China, were actually trying to make all these alternative plans by seeking PR in places like Canada. Canada was one of the most popular places, and a lot of them were holding dual passports. That was so long ago, and I think today a lot of them have actually returned to Hong Kong in the early days post-97 because the confidence then returned back to Hong Kong. But I don't know about now. I mean, the fact that they're changing the mood there, so this may perhaps trigger a lot of emigrations again.
Yeah, I actually watched the handover ceremony. It was actually quite a bit of a media spectacle, right? It was done with some aplomb and some sort of fireworks, as it were. And so the sort of lowering of the British flag and the raising of the Chinese flag and the SAR, I think, does the Special Administrative Region have its own flag?
Yeah,
it does.
It's a flower. I forgot the name of the flower.
Yeah, right. So it has...
I think it's cherry blossom, if I'm not mistaken.
Is it cherry blossom?
No, oh, okay. No, it's not.
It's not like hibiscus. It starts
with B, bauhinia or something.
Oh, okay.
Oh, okay. So, I mean, you know, Yem, you would have been quite young in 1997.
Oh, yes, very young.
Yeah, see, but you know, you've all grown up now.
I wouldn't remember anything.
So it's an orchid.
It's an orchid.
It's called Bauhinia blackiana.
Oh, there you go.
Well, yeah. There you have it. If it means anything to the orchid-loving people who are...
Not sure what the significance is to Hong Kong.
Yeah, something I never really thought about. I do remember this additional flag. I never asked what was on it, strangely enough. Or maybe I did, but it's almost 20 years ago. Also this morning on Current Affairs, Jason Lim will speak to Mohammad Haziq Jani. He's a researcher at the International Center for Political Violence and Terrorism at the Rajaratnam School of International Studies in Singapore. And he's going to be looking at the violence in Rakhine State, because Rakhine State is the westernmost state, well, that along with Chin State, that border Bangladesh. We've had a lot of... violence there, and of course over several years, and hundreds of thousands of Muslims displaced internally, held in internment camps, and then we had that rather tragic outflow of people trying to escape Rakhine State, of course, being part of Myanmar, in boats. So the boat people problem, this is a long-standing problem, and every so often there's a flare-up, and Jason will be speaking to Mohammad Haziq in order to understand what's happening there. Today we also have Ringgit and Sense with you, Julian, and it's Ringgit Ringin, because it's the last Ringgit and Sense of the month.
Correct. So if you have any pressing money issues, do call in or text in or tweet in. A professional money planner would be standing by to answer your questions.
Okay. Has there been a pattern of call-ins? I mean, do you notice, having done this for, you know, a long time now, that what are people most concerned about? And do they frame their questions in a way that makes them sound like they actually have some sense of what the issues are?
Well, I think that it's good that there are quite a lot of the millennials and the younger people calling in. Some of them are quite lucky, saying that, oh, I've inherited about $500,000 from my parents. What do I do with that, right?
It's a happy problem.
That's a good problem to have. But, you know, you can never stray too far away from the objectives in life when you're asking about money questions. And I guess while they are kind of in the same vein, each of them will be quite individualized and different. And that's what we're here to do, which is to really put you at ease and comfort you in some of those issues that you might have.
Yeah. Did you ever, I mean, would you ever avail yourself of a program or a service like this, calling in and speaking about your personal finance problems?
I did call in. I was a caller many years ago.
To the Ringgit Ringgit. Do you remember what your question was?
Credit card problems, basically.
Oh, okay.
Anything, you know, a typical guy in KL, late 20s, you know, number one priority is on maxing up your credit cards. So I think the first one was, and I think, I can't remember, was it the guest or you, Julian, that advised me that... it's not just about clearing the debts very fast. It's about how you prioritize, particularly the interest rates. So that was the first time that I realized that, okay, not all credit cards. Pretty silly, actually, because I work in a bank at that moment in time. But yeah, not all credit cards charge the user in the same manner. And it's not about the bottom line either. It's not about that 18% or 11%. It's about how they charge the compounding interest, many things. So... today I am, you know, I only have one credit card, working credit card. That's great. Nearly credit card debt free. Nearly.
Excellent.
Okay. Now we have a quick look at the news. I know this is going to be stunning for so many of us, and I even dread announcing it, but ABBA is to reunite. I mean, I don't know how to... beyond that.
Okay, but... I have been to the ABBA Museum in Stockholm. In fact, when you arrive in Stockholm...
There's a museum dedicated to ABBA?
Yes, and it's far more important than the Nobel Museum, where Alfred Nobel You know, basically has all the artifacts and all that.
And also Alfred Nobel, who invented the dynamite.
Yeah, they even have that replica of the first dynamite. Yet. That is an attraction, agreed. But, you know, everybody in Stockholm wanted everyone else that it doesn't live in Stockholm to actually go and see the ABBA Museum.
Oh, the ABBA Museum. Now, I don't know, is this something that you would be attracted to, Julian? You
absolutely. I would definitely go. I mean, I'm not. I might not be one of the biggest fans of the songs, you know, but this was, they were very iconic in the 70s, and I remember my uncles and aunts were totally into them, and there's something very nostalgic about it. So this coming back together, I mean, I can only conclude two things. Either they're doing it for the money, or they're saying, take a chance on me again.
Right? Oh, that. You didn't even have time to think about that. That was like on the spur. How did you?
Oh,
okay. Yeah, it is lame. No, okay. So they're reuniting for a new digital entertainment project. Apparently, they split up some 30 years ago. We have a lot of anniversaries. I mean, you know, Hong Kong reuniting with the, you know, with the motherland almost 20 years ago, and the Swedish pop group splitting up 30 years ago.
That ABBA is trying their hand at digital, so that's the core reason why they're reuniting. Because of course, because
they must have made a gazillion dollars from their.
Perhaps.
Maybe they spent it. I don't know. But maybe they need to call in to Ringgit Ring In in order to get advice about how to spend their gazillions. But
maybe they already have spent it all.
Have either of you ever watched ABBA live in concert?
No. I'm sure it must have been just mesmerizing.
Okay. Yeah. Any of you have, please tweet us and tell us what the experience was like. I've watched Air Supply, but live in concert, but I don't think that counts. I mean, it's not the same level. They're not the same league, right? Air Supply and ABBA. Or was Air
I don't know how you
big?
Define that, because Air Supply had a huge fan base as well, but
it did,
possibly not as big as ABBA.
ABBA was truly global, and I think for many of us, but for both bands, I think that the lyrics of the songs live on in our memory banks. You know, you just have to push the right button.
Which one, Air Supply or ABBA?
I think both, because the lyrics are very distinct. I think that was it. Okay, moving on to other serious business. I say other because I think ABBA's reunification
Absolutely.
Is in fact quite serious. Anti-government protests in Venezuela. Apparently hundreds of thousands of people have taken to the streets to protest the president, Nicolas Maduro's government. And it's come after a recall referendum process was suspended. So there's an attempt to remove the president, who was in fact duly elected. But that recall process was marred by fraud, according to officials. Some 200,000 people had signed a petition for a recall. It's interesting that in some countries you have this process. You can elect somebody, but mid-term you can in fact have that election negated through a recall process. I believe that I've seen this happen in the U.S. as well. I think they have some states of the U.S. have a provision for a recall. An interesting thing. Also to note in the news, Nintendo is having problems despite the popularity of Pokemon Go.
Yeah, and it's worth noting that Pokemon Go is on the resurrection. Last night, Pokemon Go revamped their whole spawn program and the whole reward program to allow for greater people to participate in the game. It is part of the Halloween celebration. So you could see a resurgence of people actually playing back Pokemon Go. Those that were uninstalling the game before is now reinstalling to play the game.
Okay, Ibrahim, I know this is maybe an embarrassing moment for you, but I'm going to out you as a Pokemon goer.
Yeah.
And
I'm not sure if that is an embarrassment in this day.
Actually, I'm very proud of it. Yeah.
Are you?
It's the other way around.
Can I ask you a question? I've noticed fewer and fewer people swarming around shopping malls and parks in my neighborhood, looking at their screens. I mean, has there been a drop-off? I mean, from the...
There has been a drop-off, absolutely.
But do you think it's significant?
It is very significant. In fact, our in-house techies, right, those that work at the tech department, they're all have installed it altogether, actually. And this is the whole process of addiction, right? Because Pokemon Go is a type of addiction, and you get any addiction specialist, they will argue that you have to have a sustained kind of reward if you want to get that person or user particularly attached to that particular program.
Isn't Pikachu enough?
No.
isn't right Pikachu a reward in itself?
After a while, you would see that not even, you know, 1,000 Pikachu could satisfy your want and need.
Oh my God, have you got any? Did you get any?
Yeah, of course I have.
You did? You did? Oh my, I only got the Bulbasaur.
Right,
and then at level 5 I
quit. You can see, Pokemon Go is trying to resurrect the game by, you know, jigging it to allow for greater intensity for people to actually play the game.
Okay, but the point is, all the hype around Pokemon, it hasn't helped Nintendo. And so Nintendo has issued a profit warning.
Mm-hmm. And they're blaming a bunch of other stuff, including strong yen.
Oh yeah, I mean, operating in Japan, they would be affected by the yen. Also, they are coming up with a new console, which is called Switch. And I've seen the very nifty advertising for it. They advertise it as some sort of a must-have lifestyle product, even by adults. Taking their Switch everywhere they go and having a new paradigm of how you play games with your friends. So I think the investing community is really confused by that, about whether that would actually do well or not. The other thing significant that's happening is they're going to put very legendary game Super Mario Brothers on mobile phones, and that also represents a paradigm shift for Nintendo.
You know, Jillian, in the story, there's a really strange moment because we learned that Nintendo had purchased a baseball team, the Seattle Mariners, and, you know, talking about mergers and acquisitions and, you know, what companies go out and buy. So why would a company like Nintendo buy a baseball team? And, you know, did make sense to their bottom line.
Yeah, that's like the kind of vertical integration that we were talking about, Sharad, where, you know, vertical integration involves purchase of companies up and down the supply chain rather than in a lateral movement of the supply chain, right? Lateral means buying over your competitors. So, I don't know, buying into a baseball team might add to the kind of learnings that are needed for creating a new baseball game.
Well, might be. Anyway, we'll be right back after this at BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Can I Get a Witness by Marvin Gaye. You're listening to The Morning Run. I'm Sharad Kutin. With me, Ibrahim Sani and Julian Ng. Marvin Gaye, one of my favorite singers, and what a tragic end to his life. You remember it? Do you remember it? How he ended?
The dad actually shot
him.
Actually, the dad wanted to shoot the mom, but he came in the way and the dad shot him.
And Marvin himself, and I know this is a family radio show, but, you know, Marvin himself was, you know, really caught up with, you know, a whole host of addictions. It really was.
It was the 70s, Sharad. I mean,
he didn't die in the 70s.
No, he didn't. Oh, 80s. Oh,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah, he might dimension later. And he, you know, really had a tragic decline. Anyway, maybe not the time of day to talk about tragedies like that. But it happens to the best of us, apparently.
Let's talk about other world tragedies.
Okay, I'm going to choke for a second. No, honestly, you know, the world is such a complicated place, and it's gotten more complicated because we now have technology to increase the complexities of our lives and the moral and ethical decisions that we need and political decisions we need to make over our lives. Big data. And if you think of a fiction like a Minority Report, you know, it really was anticipating this whole idea that, you know, the analytical power of data, big data, can even predict behavior, right? So that was the kind of assumption that you can even anticipate, because what we think is unique is, in fact, just a series of patterns, pattern behavior and such. And so some countries are now trying to put this into play.
Oh, which one is that?
Well, I'm going to give you a guess. It's a big country to the north and west of and east of us. Very big country.
My geography is really bad. I guess it's China, right?
Yeah, your guess is right. China, in this headline story from The Independent, China wants to give all of its citizens a score, and their rating could affect every area of their life, underscoring this somewhat benign initiative is the story of big data. But would you want a score? I mean, everybody's scoring everything. We're constantly talking about, you know, rankings and listings, and now Britain is, in fact, trying to push towards ranking its universities with bronze, silver, and gold. But would you want a ranking?
Already we see that we are being ranked. The society has already ranked us in financial performance and financial prudence, right? If you go to a bank, we already get some sort of scoring. It varies country to country. It varies the kind of granularity in terms of the financial data. This particular rating, right, it's based, that China wants to do, it measures how trustworthy, quote-unquote, you are, and it basically gives the rating that could affect every area of their lives. So the question is, if we are already being ranked on financial prudence, this is just an extension of that. This is just to see how trustworthy you are in committing crime, in committing terrorism, and other matters.
I totally disagree with that, though, because I think that the financial ranking is all about the protection of the financial institutions that dish out all these financial products to see whether you're qualified for this. But this kind of political karmic count is more about control, right? Political control and political manipulation so that the people in power can stay in power. China, of course, wants to be that totalitarian government. So this is not only bad for the people, but it's bad for China itself, because you are molding people to act in a certain way. They don't necessarily think in that certain way. And in fact, a lot of these criminals would probably find new ways to hide themselves. They wouldn't necessarily, or not even criminals, or perhaps some suppressed political dissidents would find new ways to address themselves. But it's very bad for China because this kind of suppression would result in the total decimation of the kind of innovation that they want to extract out of their citizens, and moving into the future, how can they be competitive to countries like the United States, which is completely unfettered in the way they think about things and the way they innovate?
You know, one of the parts of the conversation I had with Joseph Lien in The Breakfast Girl today was precisely this, you know, what happened 20 years ago? What happened to those promises? And, you know, he alluded to a kind of what he called a totalitarian impulse that's in China that, you know, leads to attempts to control. But, you know, but Gillian, I come back to your point. Yeah, not so great for innovation for an open society. We assume all those things are, you know, help with capitalism and business and entrepreneurship. But I wonder if it's not just about, you know, it's, you know, identifying the margins, you know, of criminality, but that everybody is going to be in this thing. Everybody's going to be ranked, and the calibrations can get finer and finer. And, you know, in the past, it would be like you make a pledge, right? All governments had was your outward pledge. But now they can track your behavior, because your consumer behavior, what you do online, all is beyond what your stated intentions are. It's about what you actually do.
Yeah. So this is, again, already happening, right? Because, you know, financial institutions already track what you buy. Your internet service provider already knows what sites you visit. Your telecom provider knows exactly where you are and for how long that you are at that particular place. All this information is already there. The government is just controlling it in terms of connecting it all together. Whether or not it's the right thing or not, this is the debate this morning, right?
Yeah, I mean,
but you see, the argument that was used by Julian just now was that for financial protection, it's a bit different because they want to give protection to the financial institutions to...
So that's justified.
Yeah. So
in a way,
This is the same thing, isn't it? This is to give protection to the state, because the way they argue, the way China argues is that in order for China to be a safer place, this has to be done. Isn't this the same argument that financial institutions use?
Why does the state need protection from its own people? That's the question.
Yeah,
right?
And in fact, you know, there's an asymmetry between the individuals that make up any kind of nation state and the state itself. The state is already all-powerful, and what we've had is, over the last 100 years, an attempt to protect individuals against the state, because if there are any violators, it's actually the state. It's the state that is violating the rights of individuals, not the other way around.
That's the basis of gun rights in the United States, right? They want to protect themselves against
the possibility of tyranny,
of a despot.
Right? Yeah, and they came out of a European experience of tyranny, right? So they had a real and legitimate
reason. Not that
we're
supporting gun ownership or anything like that, but I don't know. I find this really dystopic and really scary, and you know, it's kind of, it's a very Orwellian kind of view where our political leaders control our minds, control our thoughts. And I don't want to live in that kind of society.
This is 1984 all over again. And
oh, my goodness, it's Back to the Future. Okay, we're coming up.
You know, when ABBA is going to come back together and form, you know, this is a very strange world.
My goodness, Phil Collins, ABBA, it's really weird. But what's not weird is Keith Kam reading the first bulletin of the day, BFM 89.9. FM 89.9. You're listening to The Morning Run. That was "If This Room Could Talk" by Sly and the Family Stone. You know, we've had them on several times in the morning, and I like it. They have a nice rhythm. I think they're really ripe for mornings.
Like our producer said, it's very soulful.
Soulful. Yeah. Okay, that was Ibrahim Sani and Julian Ng and myself, Sharad Kutin. And it's now 40 minutes past 6, so coming up to 7 on the 27th of October. We're going to be tweeting out some references to the stories we're talking about. First up is a story that perhaps is harkens to a gentler time when people talked about work-life balance. But in this grim economic climate, perhaps, you know, those days are gone. We should, you know, all sort of double down and just talk about hard work and holding on to our jobs, really. But this story is about a French law, and a French, I think, you know, perhaps quite willing to buck history, French law that makes it illegal to email employees after work hours. Basically, there's a certain sanctity about work, your life outside of work, and it cannot be impinged upon by bosses and peers.
I don't think you need to resort to this kind of ruling, because all you need to do is to make a law to the effect that you don't have to answer your emails. But whoever is crazy enough to send out emails after working hours, that's their prerogative, right? You don't have to legislate against that kind of thing. But I do agree with the spirit of what they want to achieve here, which is that your after work hours are totally sanctified. It is yours. You don't need to respond to your bosses. You know, I'm a buyer of that.
There are two laws that I believe is connected to this. Number one, the law in the UK that says that the commute time is considered work hour. And I don't know whether they've made it into a rightful
law. Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, and there's another one, Sweden imposing only a six-hour work. Because
I agree with that too.
Six-hour work day.
And because they've done, you know, studies, it's basically your most productive for 6 hours only at the office. So why waste office resources? Why waste time when you can just do something else, right? So that 6 hours is just compact, pure work. And you can do whatever you want after that.
You know, it's very interesting that we've learning over history to manage time, you know, in curious way. I mean, we developed the calendar. And some of it, of course, is related to natural cycles, right? But some of it, not really. And, you know, you remember the good old days when people worked 5.5 days? I know some people still do, but it's a really odd thing. I mean, this
it
half
is an odd
day.
Thing.
Like,
if you think about it, right, you know, generations ago when, you know, we were toiling and tilling the soil. Yeah, tilling the soil.
toiling in the sand.
You know, you wake up in the morning at dawn, right, or at daybreak, you know, the rooster crows and there you go, off you go to work at the farm. And you work.
I like your really pastoral description of this whole
thing.
And
you're done. You're done by lunchtime. You are really done by lunchtime.
Because it's too hot to go.
Yeah, because it's too hot, so off you go, right? Isn't that a 6 hour work day, if you ask my opinion?
Actually, that's right. It's 6 to 6. Yeah. 6 to 12,
yeah,
right?
6 to 12 noon.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I don't know where they got the science of, you know, what is an optimal number of hours to work. Because clearly, we all have encountered people who do very little, no matter how much time you give them to do it, any task, right?
So we have those, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is assuming that people are efficient in their use and management of time. But I like this idea that we have become less concerned about the, you know, just the formalities where you have to work an 8-hour, you know, work day to let's work smart. I like that idea. I think in principle, it's something that I could get behind.
Yeah. You know. So, you know, 6 years ago, 7 years ago, when I worked at a bank, the company issued BlackBerry to me. And they said, we're going to pay your mobile bill, and this phone belongs to the company, but you can use it until it depreciates to nothing, right? Basically, it's yours. And
which it did after a while, because BlackBerry is now no longer with us.
Yeah. But the price that I paid was that I have to answer any call coming from the office. I have to answer any emails that come through my inbox. At that moment in time, I thought that was still a good bargain, because, you know, a free phone is still a free phone. It's only until I realize, oh my God, I'm working 24/7 because of this nonsense email that keeps on coming in, right?
It never stops. Yeah. And I think the best thing about the BlackBerry was that Frogger game.
I never had a Frogger. But you remember even the precursor to that, the pager? Did you ever get? I mean, were you working when pagers were given to employees? I had one. I worked for a company and they were producing men's reviews. This is in the mid-90s. Mm. And, you know, I was given a pager and I was like, what's this for? And I said, well, when we page you, you call us back. I mean, that basically is what a pager does, right? It sends you a message saying, call back to so-and-so. And I really resisted that for a while, you know. But when the phone came, it was very different because I didn't see it as...
How old are you, Sharon? I mean, like...
I am... Oh,
when the phone came, like... No, did you precede Alexander Graham Bell?
No, I don't mean that phone. I mean the hand phone. When the hand phone came. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, even a pager.
Yeah.
How many young people today would even recognize it? They found it on the roadside. They think... It's some sort of bomb, right? One of those things that dropped from drones.
I think what was totally surreptitious about the whole process was that the corporations and the advertisers and the gadget producers sold it as a sort of status symbol. I mean, you didn't mind owning a BlackBerry, you didn't mind owning a pager because, hey, you've arrived somewhere, when what they were really trying to do is to get more of your time for free.
Enslave you.
Yeah.
Okay. We're also enslaved by all kinds of ideas about what benefits us. So we have an article. It's actually quite a fabulous article, reading through it. And it's from The Guardian. And the headline is, "Don't floss, peel veg, or wash your jeans. 40 things you can stop doing right now." It's not said in the headline, but what you can stop it right now, because they're really not as effective as you think they are. Anything struck you in this list?
Yeah,
it's a long list.
You know, I've believed in this for a long time, drinking 8 glasses of water a day. The article says that somebody somewhere came up with this, but it's not actually necessarily true. And for me, I just feel that the rule to guide you as to how much water you should drink is that when you get thirsty, you drink water, and you don't have to make sure that you artificially infuse liquids into your body every so often. I think that's really misplaced.
Yeah, well, that's true. But in the world where people often forget to do things, or they don't even read their own body signals, mm-hmm. right? Perhaps you know, a little rule like this
I don't think you can forget to drink water like you can't forget to eat. Like, would you forget to eat? So yeah. that's my argument, right? Your body tells you what to do.
But a lot of people are dehydrated. A lot of people don't, you know, and or if they're thirsty, they mistake it for hunger. Or if they're thirsty, they take some sugar drink, which actually gives them, more than they actually need. So yeah.
When we break fast, right, during Ramadan, we are highly advised to drink a lot of water and eat some sweet stuff, either dates or whatever, and go pray. And then when we come back, that's when the real hunger sets in. Are you really, really hungry? Or are you just, you know, you could make do with just one slice of bread or something like that, you know? So, you know, clear that whole, you know, hunger and thirst first.
Okay. Washing your jeans. Now, this I found really disturbing, because I came from a generation where we, you know, as a teenager, the virtues of dirty jeans were extolled. And, you know, you would suffer all kinds of indignities by washing your jeans, you know, from your peers. But so this is advice saying don't wash your jeans?
This is from the head of Levi's. What about washing your hair every day? You don't need to do that.
Well, I don't, because I don't have hair.
Right. And my favorite, pressing the close button in a lift. I mean, there is absolutely no reason for that button to be there, and people should have their fingers cut off if they so much as try to press the close button, because it results in all sorts of accidents. I don't know why Malaysians are so preoccupied with closing the lift door.
What about because, people who jab just, it like endlessly?
Because, yeah, exactly, right? Because
hasten the closing.
You just need to wait for less than, I've counted this by the way, less than 3 seconds and the lift door will close. You wouldn't be able to save a lot of time for it. And if I were a lift designer, I would actually tick out the close button.
Okay, there are other things like peeling vegetables. I just had to peel it. I peel vegetables, but they're saying, well, you know, you lose a lot of good stuff. But I think maybe there's a lot of muck on the peel that you want to get rid of. But they're saying most of the good stuff is in the peel.
The fibers.
The fiber. Yeah, I'm not sure. Anyway, there's this long list. It's like 40 items. Read it. We've tweeted out the link. Read it and tell us what struck you and what you're going to hold on to despite the overwhelming evidence that it's completely useless.
Let me just rattle off about four more. Discarding out-of-date food, you don't need to do that. Stretching before exercise, standing in line in the departure gate at the airport. Have you seen people like queue up for 10, 15 minutes? You'll get your seat, don't worry, because
it's a sign.
The plane won't leave without you. And lastly, my favorite also, reading the news. Actually, you don't become smarter reading the news.
Oh, I think
some would disagree.
Yeah, I mean, you know, who are these people? You know, The Guardian, I don't know. Guardian of Good Sense. Well,
you only need to listen to BFM.
Yes, that's true. And in fact, we're coming up to the next news bulletin, the top of the hour, where you'll be given a chance to not read the newspapers because it's going to be told, the news is going to be read to you. But before that, we have Memphis Train by Buddy Miles, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.